Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm swell.
I'm so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-controversies, Joe Russo, one half of the brotherly directing duo behind the two most recent Avengers films, as well as Netflix smash hits like The Gray Man, has turned himself into a bit of a punching bag online thanks to his recent press tour for his latest Netflix smash hit, The Electric State. I don't think anyone would disagree with his thoughts on the box office success of the Marvel movies, at least in one very specific way. In a very real way, they were keeping the lights on in movie theaters during the back half of the 2010s. Though, you know, again, we could get into arguments about the extent to which training a generation of filmgoers that movies should all be big cinematic events has kind of brought us to the point where something like Black Bag, which we're going to be talking about later, is written off as just a streamable little light thing that, you know, people don't need to show up to the theaters for. Yes, you know, Avengers Endgame ate up 80% of the available screens or whatever when it was released, but that's because the demand was there. It was literally like the most anticipated film in the last decades. I don't know. I don't know that there will ever be a film that opens like that again. We could talk about audience problems another day. More controversial is perhaps that Russo seems unhappy with mere commercial success, right? There is a desire there for critical approval as well, and Academy recognition on top of that. And what is keeping the big budget blockbusters of the sort he's been making from receiving that adulation? Is it their quality? Is it, you know, maybe they aren't taken seriously enough? Or is it Harvey Weinstein? Wait, what's that? Here's Russo. He's talking to the Sunday Times in England when asked why mainstream movies nabbed so few Best Picture nominations last year. Quote, "This trend was started by Harvey Weinstein. He vilified mainstream movies to champion the art films he pushed for Oscar campaigns. Popular films were winning Oscars before the mid-1990s, when Weinstein started mudslinging campaigns. It affected how audiences view the Oscars, because they've not seen most of the movies. We're in a complicated place. Things we should all be enjoying collectively, we instead punch each other in the face over." End quote. Now, set aside the obvious jokes here about this being Harvey's real crime, et cetera, et cetera. Let's acknowledge that there's a kernel of truth here, right? Miramax was undoubtedly successful at whipping up awards fervor for a specific sort of indie feature. And there's still a bunch of inaccuracies here, right? One of them is this idea that Miramax movies weren't popular, which just flies in the face of reality. Movies like Shakespeare in Love, Pulp Fiction, Good Will Hunting, Chicago, these all grossed more than $100 million back when that meant something. And even a movie like The Crying Game, which had this kind of big wild twist, I won't spoil it for anyone just in case you haven't seen The Crying Game, was the 20th highest grossing movie in 1992. It was an Oscar contender. It won some awards. Huge hit, huge box office hit. Miramax knew how to sell these movies to people. They weren't all enormous blockbusters, but they could get people to show up for the indie stuff. The biggest idea here, the biggest problem here is this idea that after the rise of Miramax, it became impossible for big movies to win Oscar gold. And while this is directionally true, many of the Best Picture winners in recent years were seen by relatively few people compared to years past. It is not true. It's not totally true. It's maybe a little bit true, right? Like, just last year, Oppenheimer grossed nearly $1 billion at the box office. Argo did nine figures domestically, as did Slumdog Millionaire. Return of the King was an enormous hit, as was Gladiator. And yes, we've had more movies like Moonlight and Anora win Best Picture this year than in decades past, right? It's far from impossible for mainstream fare to win. The big issue, the biggest problem really, is the decline in overall quality of what constitutes popular fare. I mean, look back to the mid-1990s. Let's go back to mid-1990. Let's go back to 1995, 30 years ago this year. Apollo 13 was the second highest grossing movie of that year. If that was released today, 30 years later, it's a straight-to-streaming movie on HBO. Toy Story was the number three movie. It revolutionized animation. Nothing approaching that quality on the animation side of things has done anything close to that sort of business in recent years. And this isn't to say there aren't good animated films. There aren't animated films that don't make money. I'm saying that, like, the idea of a big game-changing movie like Toy Story earning enough money to make it number three at the box office just does not compute. These last couple weeks, I've heard lots of people talking about watching Crimson Tide and how much they love Crimson Tide following the death of Gene Hackman. That movie does not get made today. That movie does not get made today. I'm sorry, it just doesn't. And even the franchise fare was better. I'm sorry, Die Hard with a Vengeance and GoldenEye, both of which came out in 1995 and were in the top 10 at the box office, are better than virtually any franchise movie released in the last 36 months. I don't think there's even a real big question about that. The movie that wound up winning Best Picture that year was Braveheart, which was the 21st highest grossing movie of the year. And there's an interesting congruence here. The equivalent spot on last year's chart went to If, the movie If, which also happens to be the first movie on the 2024 domestic box office chart to be wholly original. That is, not a sequel, not based on a book, not based on a comic, whatever. I don't think anyone would mistake If for Best Picture material, right? I didn't hate that movie. It was fine. It was a fine kids movie, whatever. That is not a Best Picture equivalent movie. My point simply is that there's a real quality issue on the higher end of the box office. These movies are often well made. They're often entertaining. We talk about a lot of them on this show. I give lots of them thumbs up, but they are not Oscar caliber films. They just aren't. I'm sorry. They're disposable cogs of franchise machinery at best. And again, nothing wrong with that. It keeps the lights on at the movie theaters. I'm fine with it. I just don't think you can have it both ways. To quote a famous TV character, that's what the money is for, right? That's what the money is for. But maybe this is all just snobbery. Maybe I'm just a big snob here. I don't know. Peter, should the Academy be more accommodating to movies like those made by Joe Russo and his brother at Oscar time?
Yeah, I mean, The Electric State, I haven't seen it yet, but it has, last I checked, a 14% rating on Rotten Tomatoes. So, you know, if you go with the idea that the critics are always wrong, and that specifically Sonny Bunch is wrong, but really that, like, the critics in general are just like a mass of bad opinions, then yeah, I think that that should be the big winner for next year's in the Best Picture, right? Like, we should, I mean, Netflix has a lot of money. They can get stuff nominated, right? Like, look what happened with Emilia Perez. They could get The Electric State nominated. I don't think anybody in The Electric State has praised Hitler.
I mean, that we know of. Anything's always possible.
Yeah. What do you even make of this? Like, it's such a weird argument to blame Harvey Weinstein for this. Like, Harvey Weinstein made it impossible for big budget movies to win Oscars, which is why the third Lord of the Rings film won an Oscar in 2000, was it three, I think, four, right? Like, in the early aughts. Well after Harvey Weinstein had run through the Oscars, right? Like, for a decade.
A series of films that was produced by, we should note, Harvey Weinstein.
Wait, was it?
Yeah.
But it was a giant budget movie. It was a giant
Lord of the Rings movie.
Zillion dollar budget.
Miramax was an early participant. I don't know. I forgot about that. They have executive producer credits.
Oh, maybe it is his fault then. All right. There you go. I give. Should have been that.
I just think the issue here is, again, set aside the Harvey Weinstein of it all. It really is this desire. There is an obvious desire to be taken seriously as an artist in addition to making all of the money. And those two things don't have to be in tension. Again, look at somebody like Christopher Nolan. But they are obviously very clearly in tension with the Russos and what they make. I don't think that that's a particularly insane thing to say. You just kind of have to accept it. You just sleep in your bed full of money. That's fine.
The Electric State, like I said, I haven't seen it. It seems like it's especially bad. But
I haven't seen it.
But I haven't seen it. So let's talk about a movie I have seen made by the Russo brothers, The Gray Man, which is, I mean, I like the Ryans, actually both of them. I especially like Ryan Gosling. I like a stylish spy action thriller. And that movie is the most forgettable thing you could imagine. It's literally like a black hole, right? Like the black hole from Interstellar just like ate that movie inside my head. And I know I've seen it, but it's just like, what even was that?
I remember nothing about it. Just nothing. Ryan Gosling is in it. I remember, that's literally all I remember.
There's a nightclub sequence
in the streets of Prague, if I remember correctly.
And then there's that shootout that has like some car chase element and ends like there's a water fountain, I think.
None of this is helping me, guys, right? Like
Ana de Armas is in it.
I forgot about that.
That doesn't help me either.
She has the worst costumes that anyone has ever put Ana de Armas in. I remember that as well.
But like, if you're gonna make movies like The Gray Man, you are not going to be nominated for an Oscar. On the other hand, Netflix keeps giving them $200 million to make movies.
Yeah, and here's the other thing, right? I have gotten to the point, Alyssa, where I simply cannot be bothered by this anymore. And this is, Joe Russo is kind of a punching bag in the world of, you know, film, Twitter, online discussion, whatever, because he gets these enormous amounts of money to make these totally disposable things. But like, that business model seems to be working for Netflix. It doesn't make any sense to me. It does not compute for me on any level. You would think that they could make 10 movies that cost $30 million a piece. And like five of those would equal, you know, whatever this one does. And then the rest would be gravy and like whatever. I don't know. It doesn't make any sense to me, but it works for them. Good for them. They're doing it. They're, you know, they're providing jobs for lots of people, whatever. I don't care how they spend their money. And I find their success confusing on a certain level, but it works for them. Fine. Let him make those movies. Why does he also, you know, need the praise? You can have the money. You don't necessarily get the praise.
Yeah. And this may be sort of irrelevant to the rest of this discussion, given, you know, how silly this whole thing is. But I also think it's kind of a misunderstanding of what ended up happening with Miramax, right? I mean, both Canaletta in Hollywood Ending and Peter Biskind in his Down and Dirty Pictures, which is about Miramax and Sundance and sort of the rise of independent film, kind of make the argument that part of the way Weinstein became sort of an Oscars conquering monolith was by getting really good at selling kind of mid-range garbage, right? I mean, you know, Miramax went from the studio that kind of like made Quentin Tarantino to a place that was pushing out stuff like Il Postino and Life is Beautiful and, you know, Chocolat. Just like really sentimental garbage that they were kind of dressing up as prestige fare. I like Shakespeare in Love. I find it just extremely enjoyable and fun to watch. But like, people were kind of scandalized when that won Best Picture, right? It was considered a victory for, sort of a fluff over substance. And so, you know, it is fascinating to see that sort of Russo ride in so confidently on something that so demonstrates his ignorance of the industry and Weinstein's role in it. But I do think there is a spectacular difference between something like Shakespeare in Love and something like The Gray Man, right? I mean, Shakespeare in Love it's silly, it's sentimental, but it's incredibly fun. The sort of retelling of, you know, the Romeo and Juliet origin story, you know, Rupert Everett is really good in it as, you know, Josephine's sort of rival playwright. It's a wonderful early Gwyneth Paltrow role, great performance by Jeffrey Rush, sort of like the theater's backer and manager. I mean, it's just, you know, I've seen that movie a couple of times in the two decades since it was released, but it's, you know, wildly memorable down to the sort of recurring joke about how, you know, the original title for the play is, you know, Romeo and Ethel, the Pirate's Daughter, right? And it's like, yes, the Oscars are never going to reward just like generic laundry folding slop. They're not. It is sort of sad to see Russo out there kind of so thoroughly exposing himself.
I will defend Joe Russo here in the sense that I do think he's right that the theaters do need Marvel or something like Marvel to stay afloat. There is a real need for something that gets audiences back into theaters. We just had the lowest grossing weekend of the year. I understand the worries that accompany having such, you know, kind of dominant, monolithic, blockbuster-type film sucking up all the oxygen. But at the same time, you know, it's better that than nothing.
Marvel movies should exist. They, you know, when they were good, they play a healthy role in the movie ecosystem. But, it's also the case that, like, as their quality continues to decline, they may not play that role in the ecosystem,
yeah.
Right? I mean... Yeah. That claim that, like, you deserve, you know, the best popular Oscar or whatever as a reward for keeping the box office alive only holds water so long as you provide, you know, continue making movies that large numbers of people want to see. And Marvel is increasingly not doing that.
But no one is doing that. I mean, not the way that the films of the 1990s, the 80s and the 1990s that won Best Picture or were nominated were able to do that. And that is... I think that's partly because of the products that are being made, partly because of the kind of general media ecosystem that just, you know, the shorthand here is that the Hollywood did not have to compete with YouTube and cell phones and video games in the same way. Video games to a little bit of an extent, but not really in the same way that they do now, right? There's just so much more competition for entertainment, for films, visual entertainment time, right? People just have a lot more options, often cheaper options, often easier options where they don't have to leave the house. And that is going to just have huge effects on what gets financed, what gets made, and what gets put into theaters. To begin with, at the same time, if Joe Russo has an idea for a movie that is the Apollo 13 of 2025 or 2028, Joe Russo is in a better position than almost any human not named Christopher Nolan to get a giant sack of money to make that movie. Okay, there's probably 10 people who are in a better position. I don't know, maybe it's even a list of 40 people, right? But like, this is a guy who has for over a decade now commanded $150 million plus budgets for a movie every 2 to 4 years. Who is now getting those budgets from a streamer that doesn't even require box office backing, right? To like box office success in order to fund his movies. And if Joe Russo, I'm not saying that he can get absolutely any crazy idea financed. That's not how Hollywood works. But if he has an idea that looks on paper like it has a shot at being both a commercial and critical success and being a big awards bait film, how many other human beings have any chance of wrangling a $100 million budget for it? It's a short, short list. And Russo is on it. And like the fact that he's complaining about this stuff, like he has more opportunity to go make those movies than anybody else.
So what you're saying is he needs his Oppenheimer.
Not even his Oppenheimer. He like, forget that. He needs his Chocolat.
Nobody needs a Chocolat. All right.
He needs something okay. That's at all memorable.
All right. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or an controversy that the big budget blockbusters from Netflix at all just aren't getting the respect they deserve, dagnabbit? Peter.
It's not a controversy in any way. It's weird that Russo is neurotic about this. Either make the movie or take the money.
I mean, it is controversial that Joe Russo thinks they should.
I don't know. It's a controversy. You should just say whatever you want in interviews, directors. It's great. This is good fodder for the show. I want more complaints.
What would we do on our podcast?
What would we do without the interviews? That's what we need more of. All right. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. We're going to figure out the subtext of this whole conversation, that there's a real crisis out there among the audience. There's an awareness crisis, and we're going to solve it. We're going to figure out how to make sure that more than 3% of the population knows about a movie like Black Bag and that it's coming out in theaters. We've got a lot of ideas. We're going to fix this whole thing. It mostly involves giving us money. Anyway, speaking of Black Bag,
good plan.
On to the main event. Black Bag, directed by Steven Soderbergh, starring Cate Blanchett and Michael Fassbender, is what we might describe as an old-fashioned, old-school Hollywood programmer. It's a mid-budget movie from a popular genre, in this case the spy thriller genre, with some big names, some handsome locations, but it's not based on any sort of pre-existing franchise or pre-awareness, right? It's the sort of movie we used to see every studio make like 5 times a year. Every month or so, there'd be a new programmer in theaters. And those have disappeared as much of this fare has made its way to streaming. Not disappeared, just kind of made its way to streaming. The setup for this movie, Black Bag, is pretty straightforward. George, that's Michael Fassbender, is given a list of names of people who might have stolen a scary new weaponized piece of computer code, which will melt down a nuclear reactor if it is introduced to the site. On the list of people who might have stolen it, who had the capability of stealing it, is Michael's wife, Catherine, who's played by Cate Blanchett, along with couples Freddie and Clarissa and James and Zoe. The five join George for dinner, for a dinner party at George's home, also Catherine's home, of course. And fireworks ensue. George is sort of like a human lie detector whose job is to sniff out traitors in order to stop up the leaks. What follows is one half international intrigue. Though never named as such, the potential meltdown could play a key role in the Ukraine-Russia war currently underway. And one half domestic drama. This is a movie about adult relationships, a fact made very clear by the fact that the 30 minutes at the start of the film take place in the most adult setting possible, a dinner date at a co-worker's home, attended entirely by people you know from work. And while the professional stakes are always high in such a setting, as anyone who has ever sat through one of these will tell you, your dinner dates with your coworkers likely did not come with the implicit threat of being disappeared by one of your coworkers who is carrying a Glock with them at all times. In some ways,
that's how things are at the Bulwark, but I'll tell you at Reason, this all felt very familiar to me.
I guess that's fair. You know, who knows what you libertarians get up to. Anyway, in some ways, Black Bag is one of those movies that's memorable for what it isn't as much as what it is, right? Here are some of the things that it is not. It is not a franchise extension activity, the sort of movie you make to keep the gears of a series rolling. It's a standalone story. Very nice. However, it could very well be a franchise. This is the thing about standalone stories. You make a good one, it could be a franchise. You could get lots of movies about these people. More movies should try to be standalones in the hopes of becoming franchises. It's not too long. Filmmakers have a tendency to draw these things out, but Steven Soderbergh and David Koepp have put together a nice tight 90 here. I think it's a 93-minute runtime. You love to see it. And most importantly, it is not a second screen movie. It is not the sort of movie you can watch with a phone in one hand while kind of idly looking up at the screen every 30 seconds or so to make sure you understand precisely which character it was that just verbally repeated the action you saw them perform on the screen. It's just good, competent, compelling storytelling of the sort that movies used to excel at. And look, it's kind of telling. I don't think Black Bag is going to win Best Picture or anything this year. We were just talking about Oscar movies. I don't think it's that, really. But it is probably the best movie I've seen so far this year and by a fairly wide margin. Between this and Presence, Alyssa, is it fair to say that Steven Soderbergh is the only person who makes good movies anymore?
Yeah, I would say that.
That's it. It's just down to, we got one director left.
No, I mean, we have sometimes joked about sort of what this podcast should be completest about. Like, should this podcast be completest about Marvel? Should this podcast be completest about Star Wars? And I think we've basically, like, we're completest about Christopher Nolan and Steven Soderbergh. And I think that's the right decision because Steven Soderbergh just slaps. He is making great movies. He did an interview with Matt Zoller-Seitz at Vulture where he said that part of the reason he's been really committed to making shorter movies is that he never wants the length to be an obstacle to rewatching one, right? I mean, he'll have conversations with his wife where they'll talk about watching a movie and it's like, but it's 2 hours and 17 minutes. We know we're not going to finish it. And not only would I rewatch Black Bag, I would watch like 15 movies set in this universe. Because what it actually reminded me of was sort of the Thin Man movies, the whole like Nick and Nora Charles, like married detectives. This movie is super, super fun. It's my husband actually joined the three of us for the screening. And I just was thinking about like what a perfect date movie it was, right? It's like, it's a movie that is somewhat hilariously committed to the idea that, like, marriage is great. And anyone who is, you know, wasting their time either, like, messing around at clubs when they under the cover of their job as a spy when they could be at home with their wife and kids, or who's, you know, divorced and kind of making a fool of themselves, or, like, not sort of seriously headed in that direction. It's just, like, wasting their time. Marriage is awesome. I would love, honestly, for Ross Douthat to write a column about this. It's like the marriage pop culture we need. It's great to look at. Like, Cate Blanchett's clothes in this movie have caused me to, you know, just mentally revisit my entire wardrobe. It's, you know, it's witty and funny. It's not, like, if I have a complaint, I think it could have been, like, 5% sexier. But I do think some of the sort of, like, British restraint and style are what make the movie a lot of fun. It's well plotted. Like, I leaned over to Peter at one point and was like, this is what's happening in this scene, right? And then turned out, like, there was sort of an extra twist on top of it. It is so delightful and economical. And at a time when I, you know, look, I spend a lot of time in movies sort of checking me watch, being like, okay, we're X number of minutes in, we're at this point in the, like, Save the Cat screenplay, you know, I've had enough of this, when is it going to be over? Again, this movie felt like a bonbon. Like, I would be in a lot of trouble if this was a franchise, because I would never be able to stop, like, metaphorically eating them. It's just a treat. Movies should be fun, right? And I think, you know, to sort of go back to our cons and non segment, like, there's really nothing wrong with wanting movies to be fun and with executing that fun at an extremely high level without, you know, like, there's a craft in amusement. There's a craft in, you know, just, like, setting a table beautifully and picking out characters' wardrobes well, in, you know, writing with economy. I think Soderbergh just really enjoys making fun things extremely well, which is not to say that he doesn't make movies that sometimes have, you know, higher ideals or arguments. I mean, this movie actually includes a very interesting sort of counterfactual about whether it would have been a good thing globally for, you know, the Wagner Group to have overthrown the Putin regime. That's, like, literally just sort of, like, it's a side note, but it's sort of fun that it's in there. Fun is a purpose in and of itself. Well-made fun is a craft and a calling. And I really wish more people who are making movies were thinking about sort of the pleasure of the audience at home, you know, or in the theater. I think Soderbergh is intimately attuned to that in a way that is commercial without being condescending. And it's, yeah, I will watch everything Steven Soderbergh makes forever because of that.
One thing, a word that came up repeatedly while I was thinking about and writing about this movie for this episode was the word competent. And, like, sometimes the word competent is seen as a backhanded compliment.
Yeah.
That, like, it's like, ah, oh, well, this is fine. And I've never thought of the word that way. I've never thought of the word that way because I think it is. I think being competent at visual storytelling is no mean feat. Very few storytellers are actually good at it.
Yeah.
As a result, when I say something is competent, I mean that as a fairly high level of praise. Like,
yeah,
you're not. It's not just that you're good enough. It's that you are good. You're good at what you do, and being good at what you do is, like, a pretty high calling.
You know, I like precision of language, so I might go with something like deft or dexterous. But yes, there's a commitment to excellence in sort of every part of the production. Something like The Gorge, which we talked about a couple weeks ago, which has, like, you know, some parts of a screenplay that are, you know, pretty well executed and some that are garbage, and then a bunch of just, you know, rotten looking CGI. Like, there's just, I think all of us feel to a certain level like standards are just declining in production. And to a certain extent, you know, we know from reporting about the movie industry that the sort of expansion of CGI crunch, the sort of economic pressures that are put on effects houses, like, there are parts of the industry where sort of cost has become more important than skill. Things are being produced under conditions that don't allow people to operate skillfully. There's a real argument to be made that it's not just a question of perception, like, things actually are getting worse. So to see a movie that holds competence in high regard throughout I think feels increasingly notable.
Peter, what did you make of Black Bag?
I liked this. What I liked about it in particular was that it's basically an Agatha Christie movie. It is this sort of little tiny kind of chamber piece with a just six or seven main characters, right? You've got the six who show up at the dinner table, and then the guy who we meet in the very first scene who, well, he doesn't make it to the end of the movie. Bit of a spoiler. Right? It's basically just seven characters who play any kind of real role. There's a few other folks who are named or seen briefly. Right? And so it's play-like. It's Agatha Christie-like, right? It's kind of the locked, locked house, island murder mystery type of deal, right? Except you're trying to find the spy, trying to find the mole rather than trying to solve the murder. But it's the same idea. The movie more or less starts and ends at that same dinner table. It has this kind of nice circular, structure to it. Again, just very play-like. You can frankly just imagine a play version of this, which I always really like movies that succeed in doing, sort of in being nice and small and self-contained. And in that way, it actually reminds me quite a bit of Presence, which also was Soderbergh and David Koepp. And I think I mentioned when we did the Presence episode that after the screening I saw of Presence, there was a Q&A with the cast and crew. And the one thing that David Koepp said that I thought was really interesting was that he likes movies and he likes stories and screenplays where there's some sort of guardrail or limitation, where there's like some, like, because that like helps him sort of stay, contained, right? And he likes to sort of put the story in a little bit of a box. And you see that in both of these films. You see that actually going all the way back to some of his kind of secondary work in the 1990s, where he did a haunted house film with Kevin Bacon that I remember seeing in college called Stir of Echoes. He's made at least one more haunted house film since then. And then Kimmy as well, which we reviewed a couple of years ago, was a straight to HBO streaming film, but was excellent. And again, was just this kind of Rear Window riff that mostly took place inside the apartment of somebody who was during COVID of a person who was, I think, had some medical reasons for not going outside and was really anxious about leaving the house. And sort of this whole mystery unfolds mostly from inside her apartment. And so I just love the kind of clever, quiet, containment of this story. At the same time, while I wouldn't quite say that the story is complex, it is a little bit dense. It is something that you have to pay a little bit of attention to. Like you said, Sonny, this is not a two-screen movie. And I do think that actually limits its appeal in some way. I have talked to any number of people younger than me, including at least one family member, people who are smart folks, college educated, often, even in kind of journalism or sort of writing, reading type jobs, who have said basically that over the last 10 years, who've told me, like, yeah, I find it difficult to go to a movie theater because I can't look at my phone because I have to pay attention, right? Like, and this is a film that requires you to pay pretty close attention to the specific words and language that's said. It's not a long movie, right? So it's not 3 hours without your phone, but like this is a movie that demands a kind of engagement and attention that I think even sort of nominally sophisticated audiences, many of them don't have anymore. They just don't have the patience for it. And that's a real difference than in the 1990s, to take us back to our previous conversation, where you could just expect that people would know how to pay attention to something for a couple of hours. Yes, maybe not everyone, but like sort of middle class, often college educated moviegoers were accustomed to sitting and focusing for 2 or 3 hours at a time because there wasn't an alternative. The only thing that was twitchy at all and that sort of pulled you away constantly was like watching television. And in fact, this was an argument made about television at the time, was that, it's for low attention spans. People aren't really paying attention to it. There's a commercial every break, every 8 or 10 minutes, and 30 seconds of just like yelling at you then, right? Like, and it just kind of rots your brain. But this is nothing compared to what we got now, where people can't watch the big screen in front of them because they got a smaller screen, where I've said on this podcast many times, or at least a few times anyway, that in the past year I have on multiple occasions seen people watching TikTok on their phones in a movie theater while the movie is playing. It drives me crazy. So
we're doomed as a society. We're just doomed.
I don't know about that. At the same time, people listen to 3-hour podcasts all the time. I guess they do it while they're folding laundry. I don't know. I don't know if I think this movie actually kind of works for everyone. It definitely appeals to me. And it definitely sort of checks my boxes, I think, as it does for all of us here. But I do think there's some people will find this a little bit more dense and a little bit less accessible than we did. I do think that there's a version of this that actually does work as television. But maybe that's just because I've been watching the TV show The Agency, which stars Michael Fassbender as a spy in London with like a great cat. So this movie has Pierce Brosnan.
There's a version of this that's 10 hours long, yeah, and is a TV series. But there's, yeah, a version and of even a pretty good that's version. 10 hours long and a TV series. And that's what's the matter with entertainment these days. Too many things are 10-hour TV series when they could be 90-minute movies. I think you're right, Peter. I think you're right that there are a lot of brain-rotted internet addicts out there who will not be able to watch this 90-minute movie, just as they're not able to read a 300-page novel. Because they're constantly checking their phone, you know, in the middle of a chapter. Like, I totally agree with you that there is a certain set of person out there like that who needs Grok to summarize every chapter of the book that they're reading for them. There is absolutely a sort of person like that out there. And this is the audience problem. You know, I said we'd get to the audience problem later. There is an audience problem. Audiences are bad. And they're not going to get better. And that's why everything is broken and is going to be worse.
Sonny, can we just replace everything you say about audiences with other people?
Other people are... Voters are bad. Other people are bad. Readers are bad. People who use...
Who do you like, Sonny? Bad.
People
who listen to podcasts are bad. Everyone is bad. Everyone is bad. There's approximately 900,000 people who went to go see this movie this weekend, if I'm doing my math right, maybe 800,000. Those are the good people. Those are good people. Everybody else is bad. Sorry if you're listening and you've realized you're bad.
You can become good. You can go see Black Bag.
Go see Black Bag. You'll get the official Sonny Bunch stamp of approval. Thumbs up or thumbs down on Black Bag. Peter.
Good movie. Thumbs up.
Alyssa.
Good movie. Thumbs up. Like, great date movie.
Thumbs up. Go see it. Put your phone away for 90 minutes, animals. All right. That is it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Rupert Manderstam. Sorry for hitting the desk like that, Rupert. Without whom, this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SonnyBunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.